All right, we're ready for the first case of the morning, which is 20-8046 United States versus Cervantes. And just one housekeeping note for those present: after the third case, I plan to take a 10-minute break for the panel, and we'll be back after that. All right, United States versus Cervantes.
Judges, good morning. My name is Tom Fleener. I'm a lawyer from Laramie, Wyoming. I'm appearing today under the Criminal Justice Act, and I am honored to represent the appellant Armando Cervantes. The law in this case, gentlemen, is fairly simple and clear. What I'd ask the panel members to focus on, judges, is not to take this case and look at it in a vacuum. Rather, to look at the entire case sort of in its entirety. And I think if you do that, I would ask you to ask yourself a second question, which is, you know, did the trial court do what it could do, or did it do what it should do? And when you put those two questions together, judges, the overarching theme of my argument and the overarching theme of our brief was, you know, did Armando Cervantes receive the kind of trial that's expected in the United States? And I would argue to the members of this panel that Mr. Cervantes did not.
You see no problem at all with a man who's tried? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I couldn't see lips move, Judge. I couldn't tell who was talking. I apologize.
Well, I'll take that. I want you to be able to hear me very clearly.
I can hear you, sir. Fine. Thank you.
So you see no problem with the fact that the man was there, the jury was impaneled, he was told about the motion, he didn't have to come to that day, then absconds for 9 years?
I see.
And comes back and doesn't want to be put in jail?
No, I see a huge problem with that, Judge. And I should have said from the very onset, the Armando Cervantes appeal is in large part caused by Armando Cervantes. And please don't think that I'm somehow excusing my client's conduct from any of this. I'm saying that it was exasperated in large part by actions at the trial court. But I absolutely agree with the court that Armando Cervantes caused Armando Cervantes' problem. The question is, and I guess, Your Honor, I'd ask you to ask yourself that while Armando Cervantes was certainly more in control of this situation probably than anybody, who had a greater ability, though, to sort of put this case in its proper context? And I would argue that in this particular case, the trial court erred. The trial court was prepared to go forward in Armando Cervantes' case, come hell or high water. And I put myself, you know, interesting about the one of the more interesting aspects of this case, and I spoke with my colleague, Mr. Schott, about it. We're both from the District of Wyoming, a large state, but small population, very vast. I remember the Armando Cervantes case. I was representing somebody else in this indictment, so I remember all of the things surrounding what was going on here. I was chosen to be his lawyer, quite frankly, because of my background and knowledge of the rest of this case. It made it easier to proceed to sentencing. This was a case where Armando Cervantes was the 26th, 25th person arrested on a 27 or 28 person indictment. This was the end of the long indictments that we used to do in Wyoming. We don't do these anymore.
Counsel, sir. I have another question.
Yes, sir.
To take you to. Your argument goes to the abuse of discretion by the trial court of not granting your client a continuance.
Roger.
Now, in that argument, you seem to be saying that by failure to grant the continuance, that caused his counsel to be ineffective, which then takes us to a 2255 on ineffective assistance of counsel, which we require that issue be raised, in a habeas proceeding.
Roger.
But I didn't see anything in your briefs where you argued that his counsel did anything wrong, made any mistakes. So how was his attorney disadvantaged and caused you know, an abuse of discretion by the court.
Yes, sir. The and I, reading your brief 6 months after the fact, always in my mind, and reading the United States briefing, sort of cements things, and I realize things I should have said differently in my briefing, you know, when I read this thing 6 months later. This is a cumulative effect. This is a cumulative error that the denial of the motion to continue, Ms. Wood asked to continue the trial and withdraw from the case, the trial counsel, on January 3rd, a Sunday, in 2011. The first day coming back would have been January 4th where the trial was. You know, she had one basis, essentially. The basis was, I've been fired by my attorneys, new attorneys are coming, or fired by my counsel, new attorneys are coming on board, and I need to withdraw and continue the case. When the trial court ultimately denied that, and we started the trial the next day, and then we gave Ms. Wood the following day to review some voluminous discovery that came in really over the break, and then waited another 30 days after the jury was impaneled, sent them home, and brought them back 30 days later. What this really was, Judge, and I should have briefed it then, quite frankly, is that, you know, this was an issue with failing to, for the trial court really denying the motion to continue based on the new attorneys coming in, combined with the fact that, and the court did there was no analysis really at all, Your Honor, regarding these interlopers, as the court called them, and they probably were. And that's what, you know, I want the court to understand the facts in this case, which is, from Armando Cervantes' viewpoint, and I agree with Judge Baldock that he was certainly to blame for this, but in December of 2010, Armando Cervantes was dissatisfied with his court-appointed attorney, and he did what we're supposed to do. He hires new lawyers.
He hires them at the 11th hour, right before trial, after not communicating with the existing attorney who was trying to reach him. If you don't mind, let me follow up on Judge Baldock's question.
Yes, sir.
Sure and clear here. There are two discrete issues here on appeal. We don't have an ineffective assistance of counsel issue, right? We've got an issue related to the continuance and an issue related to the trial in absentia. That's it.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Let me focus on the trial in absentia and the public interest inquiry. And you make much of, in your brief, the fact that the court referenced its coming retirement and the implications of that. What I don't particularly understand is what's the problem with that? Why isn't that, when you consider public interest, just another factor going to the cost of delay? I mean, the exacerbating the cost of delay, the fact that a new judge would have to learn about the case, why isn't that like saying, if I don't hold the trial now, there are 50 other cases that are going to be impacted by me not doing it? What's the difference?
I think it's it's a legitimate consideration, Your Honor. I think that and there's all sorts of facts that are legitimate considerations under this public interest prong. I mean, it's a broad category, and it should bring in a lot of facts.
Okay, well, I didn't understand you to be saying it was a legitimate consideration. If you say accept the fact that it's a legitimate consideration, then what's wrong with that? If it's legitimate, why couldn't the court factor that in with a bunch of other factors? Where's the abuse of discretion in that balancing?
Our opinion is that the court treated this as sort of the sole consideration, and rather than a consideration. And I start, Your Honor, with the premise that Crosby talks about,
counsel,
which is that...
Counsel,
sir,
let me just make sure, when you say the sole consideration, are you still referencing the impending retirement point?
Yes, sir. When I say that the judge treated it as sort of the sole consideration.
And this is for what? The denial of the motion for continuance, or the holding of the trial in absentia? Which of those are you referring to right now?
I'm really referring to both, but I'm trying to focus on having the trial in absentia.
Wasn't the main consideration is that your client absconded? Not, it didn't have anything really to do, did it, with the judge's retirement? He was gone.
Well, and I appreciate the question, Your Honor, but I, when you read the record, when you read the transcripts, it was clear that while my client certainly absconded and is responsible for that, and the trial court spent just a great deal of time talking about how he wants to get this case done before his predecessor comes on board. He doesn't want, I believe he said, he doesn't want President Obama's nominee to be, saddled with this case. Is it a legitimate consideration? Absolutely. I believe the trial court abused its discretion, though, by making it really his primary and sole discretion.
It's my understanding that the court focused on the inconvenience to the juror, the inconvenience that had already taken place, the possible inconvenience that would take place if they waited till they found him and a new jury would have to be picked. It also focused on the inconvenience to the government. Is my memory failing me? Didn't it talk about those additional factors?
The court did.
All right, then. It wasn't the sole factor, then.
It wasn't the sole factor, but it was certainly a primary factor, Your Honor. And again, I think that a fair reading of the transcripts would lead a reader to come to the conclusion that, while Mr. Cervantes is certainly responsible in large part for many of these issues, there were all sorts of things that the trial court could and should have done in this particular case, which probably wouldn't have me be up here 10 years later arguing before this honorable court.
And that's interesting. Let's go back to your initial question. Your question was, could the court have done something, should the court have done something, so that somebody can get the kind of trial that they're expected to get in the United States? Well, really, is that the question here? On abuse of discretion, we're talking about what the law requires, not what the court could have done. I mean, the court could have waited. The court could have decided to do a bunch of stuff. But the question is what the law required the court to do in order to provide this defendant his constitutional rights, right?
Correct.
Okay. Let me be clear on one point. You don't contest the fact that the trial stage for purposes of Rule 43 had been reached at the time that your client absconded.
Based on the current law, including, understand the law involving Rule 43, no. By impaneling the jury, that started the trial as far as that goes. Yes, sir.
Okay. And on this question, still focusing on the continuance issue, you cited in your brief the Lamont case. And I just don't understand how that case helped you, because in Lamont, the court denied a continuance, and it was actually a fairly similar situation. Counsel got upset with his lawyer, fired his lawyer, hired another lawyer, and the court denied a continuance, and the language of the opinion was impressed the new lawyer into service to argue the case. And there, we found no abuse of discretion. I can't, for the life of me, I don't see why that case helped you.
The case doesn't necessarily help me, Your Honor. We cited the case because that's the law.
Well, okay, it is the law, and I appreciate your candor in citing it. But I mean, tell me how to get out from under that case, because that case would seem to control that your continuance argument doesn't fly.
I would agree, which is why I go back to the very first point that I made before the question began, which is to not look at this case in a vacuum. I would invite you all to take a step back and look at this case as it's happening and as it's unfolding.
Well,
and
then, counsel, could I?
Yes, sir. Of course.
Looking at the case and stepping back, it's correct, isn't it, that your client was present on January 4 for jury selection?
Yes, sir.
And on January 3rd, Ms. Wood was prepared to go to trial.
I don't concede that, Your Honor, because she'd filed a motion to continue not only for the new counsel to be involved, but she'd also filed a motion to exclude a bunch of discovery that was filed part of, given.
I'm just looking at the transcript of January 3rd, where she said, "I was still under the impression that we were ready to go to trial tomorrow," so she anticipated going to trial.
Yes, sir.
She did get the extra day. And then when Mr. Cervantes didn't show up on the 6th, she really got another month to prepare, correct?
She did. My time is up. May I finally finish my question or responding to your question, Judge? She did get another month to prepare, but I do struggle with this concept, the concept that for Rule 43 considerations that the trial began on January 4th, but for preparation of witnesses and the actual things that go on in trial, we're actually considering that the judge gave her the benefit of the doubt and didn't really start the trial until January 30th. I'm sorry, I don't think the government gets it both ways. I mean, either the trial started on the 4th and all this evidence that was late disclosed, and I appreciate the trial court giving Ms. Wood time to analyze it. I mean, I would think legally that if we're dealing January 4th from the beginning of trial because of jury selection and impanelment, we should be looking at January 4th for when the trial starts as far as examining witnesses and evidence, and that the time that the court gave her afterwards wouldn't matter as far as that goes. But I'm out of time. Do the members have any questions for me?
No.
It was an honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, good morning. May it please the court? Counsel?
Good morning.
Your Honors, my name is Thomas Schott. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney from Cheyenne. And, Your Honors, the point I would emphasize is one that Judge Holmes made with Mr. Fleener is, we are here in the context of abusive discretion review, really going to the in absentia issue, which is the more meaty issue, I think. The district court perhaps could have done something different. The district court perhaps could have held the trial in absentia sooner, or the district court could have perhaps continued it longer to allow for more time, perhaps, for Mr. Cervantes to be apprehended. But based on the record, based on what happened, the court did not abuse its discretion in doing exactly what it did, which was to continue the trial for a short time, permit the U.S. Marshals to undertake an investigation, receive evidence about that investigation to date, permit defense counsel to cross-examine the U.S. Marshal on that evidence, and also permit her additional time to prepare for trial as sort of a fringe benefit, so to speak. But ultimately, the district court's decision to proceed with trial was reasonable. It was not an abuse of discretion.
The one issue that seems to me to cut most significantly against this argument is related to the public interest criterion, and in particular the question that this was a single defendant trial. No, I'm not saying that the Tora Tora and our reference to it is controlling. That's you do, I think, a fairly nice job of explaining why that should not be the case. However, it is a factor, and it is one that it seems to me cuts against the notion that the court could not have waited because there weren't other defendants that were going to be affected. So, what additional factors in the record counteract and weigh in the balance in favor of the action the court took in light of the fact that it was a single defendant trial?
Your Honor, I would point to the factors that you mentioned to Mr. Fleener in the first part of the argument. First of all, the court's impending retirement is a factor. It's an additional burden on the court to require a new judge, new staff to be involved. Some of the other factors in question were the uncertainty as to whether this particular jury would be able to complete its service if there were an indefinite continuance or a lengthier continuance. And the public expense the judge noted that was involved in impaneling the jury. Certainly, Your Honors, the, at minimum, inconvenience to the government, which had witnesses prepared, present, ready to testify, an indefinite continuance would have at least potentially prejudiced the government insofar as government witnesses, as the court noted at some point during the proceedings, you know, witnesses might die, and obviously, years after the fact, memories fade, so there was the potential for prejudice to the government as well. So there were multiple factors that the district court identified insofar as the public interest is concerned. And certainly, Your Honor, the fact that it was a single defendant case as opposed to a multi-defendant case, I don't dispute that that's pertinent. And that in a multi-defendant case with multiple defendants who are ready to go to trial, the balancing may be different. The balancing may weigh in favor of, rather than granting a several week continuance to try to find out absent defendant, perhaps proceeding almost immediately, as soon as it's ascertained that his absence is in fact voluntary. So that might be different in a different case, but I certainly think there are multiple factors, Your Honor. One sort of interesting thing I think about that public
counsel, before we leave the single defendant issue, I was just interested in your view of where we stand on the law on that question. If we have a single defendant, is that just one factor to consider? That seems to be the tenor of the argument. Or does the fact that there's just one defendant left create any presumption against proceeding in absentia?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any case that would apply such a presumption. And as I outlined in the brief, that single defendant consideration comes from some dicta back, I believe, from the 1970s that just sort of spread. It's the kind of statement that's easy to quote and to cite. I believe, Your Honor, I would answer with what you said first. It's a consideration to be sure, depending on the facts and circumstances of the particular case. But I don't think there's any presumption that would apply against proceeding in absentia in a single defendant case. Your Honor,
counsel, it would be more than a presumption. We would have to say as a matter of law that there has to be more than one defendant. Isn't that correct? It's not a presumption. We either say you have more than one defendant before you can have a trial in absentia. If you only have one defendant, the law is you don't get to try the case.
And that would certainly be a bright line, Your Honor. I'm not aware of any court that's actually said that. The dicta from that Tortora case that Judge Holmes mentioned, I believe that's the source of all of this. I don't have the precise language in front of me, but I believe the word generally is included. And the court said something to the effect of, generally, it's difficult for us to foresee that this would be proper except in a multi-defendant case. It really is sort of classic dicta, where the court just made a statement that then was treated really later as if it were an important consideration. And it's certainly a consideration.
While in Wright, was it dicta? That's the case where we picked it up.
Right, Your Honor. And I know that I believe it's also in Edmondson. I didn't go back before this argument to trace the origins of all that. When I did it in the brief, I believe I traced it back to Tortora.
Well, it does go back, I think, to Tortora. We picked it up in Wright. We did phrase it as generally along the lines of what you're saying. All right, let's move on. I didn't refresh my memory this morning on whether Wright used it in the context of that case more than just as a general statement. So we can explore that later. Go ahead, please.
One last point about the dicta, Your Honor, that I would make is, at least in Edmondson, and I make this point in the brief as well, that's a pre-Crosby case, the Supreme Court's decision in Crosby, which really clarified that under Rule 43, you can't try someone in absentia if he absconds before trial. So Edmondson, at least, was talking, I believe, about a defendant who had absconded before trial, and the dicta popped up. That, I believe, was also the circumstance in Tortora itself. So I really would emphasize, Your Honors, the dicta is not only has its own circuit rejected it, it's not the law and shouldn't be the law. I think really what the law requires is for the district court to analyze each case on its own facts and circumstances. And if there are multiple defendants, that's a consideration. And if not, then the court looks at the facts that are before it. One important aspect of this public interest, I think, Your Honors, is the fact that it was the defendant's willful misconduct that was the result here. The fact that he was clearly unhappy with the district court's rulings. He apparently wanted these new attorneys, and the district court had properly denied that 11th hour motion based on what those attorneys had not done, which was to enter an appearance or seek pro hoc vice admission. So defendant apparently is frustrated with the judge, he's scared, whatever the case may be, he knew he needed to be back for opening statements. And he chose voluntarily to abscond. And that sort of willful conduct is really something that I think weighs into the calculus as well. And the district court was clearly aware of that. So under the pertinent considerations for trying the case in absentia, at a minimum, Your Honors, there's no abuse of discretion here. The judge's actions were not whimsical or arbitrary. He proceeded appropriately. He proceeded reasonably cautiously, I think, by allowing that additional period of time to try to get some more information about what happened. There's no suggestion that the absence was other than voluntary. So I think there's no abuse of discretion on that. In terms of the other issue, which is the motion to continue, from the government's perspective, and this is outlined in the brief, the only possible argument would be an ineffective assistance argument. And that argument's not been raised. So really, I think that's not an issue at all for the court. Any hypothetical prejudice was cured by that additional time.
Counsel, just so we're understanding the record correctly, didn't Ms. Wood say at the January 3rd hearing she needed newly produced discovery?
I would have to go back and look, Your Honor, at whether she said that at the hearing. She certainly had filed that motion to exclude based on discovery that was purportedly provided late.
Where I was going with the question was to give us a better idea of what the newly produced discovery presented her with. What are we talking about there? Is this a large amount of material? What would it take to review? I'd just like to have a little more context.
Her primary complaint, Your Honor, and she made this point explicitly, was with 83 pages of bank records, which apparently were emailed to her in mid-December. That was what she said was her primary concern. There also was some surveillance video, which was not used at trial, although associated photographs, I believe, were. But the video was not. And then some evidence, I believe, of wire transfers. She also mentioned an additional proffer statement and was talking about other proffer statements. But her primary concern, Your Honor, was 83 pages of bank records. And ultimately, in its order, which denied her motion to exclude, the district court held that she had sufficient time. She had them in mid-December. Even if the trial had gone as scheduled in early January, she would have had about 3 weeks to review 83 pages of bank records. So the district court's conclusion, Your Honor, I think was reasonable, that she wasn't prejudiced by that, that she had sufficient time. And when the court afforded her the additional day, she at least made statements indicating that she was hopeful that that would be sufficient to work out the problem. But in any event, Your Honor, it's sort of a moot point because she got the additional time after her client absconded. And it would be almost a hypothetical kind of analysis to go back now and say, well, if her client hadn't absconded, and if the trial had happened as scheduled, would she have been unprepared to do the trial at that time based on this purportedly late discovery? That's, I believe, what Mr. Cervantes is arguing here. But like I say, it's number one, she said she was prepared, or she wasn't intending to ask for a continuance until the out-of-state lawyer called her. And the district court's conclusion ultimately that she did have sufficient time to review those bank records certainly appears to be proper, Your Honor. So for all those reasons, unless the court has additional questions for me, the government would ask the court to reject Mr. Cervantes' arguments and affirm his 188-month concurrent sentences. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Pleaner, I don't believe you had any additional time.
No, sir.
Okay, so
thank you.
The case is submitted now.